This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Two local universities were recently awarded significant grants to aid in our region's fight against opioid abuse. September is National Recovery Month. So how is the Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky area recovering from being ravaged by this crisis? Joining Cincinnati Edition to talk about the issues are St. Elizabeth Healthcare Executive Director of Health Innovation and Vice President of Health Innovation at Northern Kentucky University, Dr. Valerie Hardcastle. Welcome, Valerie.
Thank you. Welcome.
And with the University of Cincinnati, our College of Nursing Executive Director of Undergraduate and Pre-Licensure Programs, Dr. Angela Clark. Welcome, Angela.
Thank you for having me.
College of Allied Health Sciences Master of Social Work Program Director and School of Social Work Associate Professor Shauna Aquavito. Welcome, Shauna.
Thank you.
And we also have School of Human Services Associate Professor and Coordinator of the Counseling Program, Dr. Michael Brubaker. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be here.
And joining us on the phone is Jack Stem. He'll share his own story of being in recovery from addiction. He's now the chair of the Peer Assistance Advisor Committee for the Ohio State Association of Nurse Anesthetists, and he's also a counselor at Hotel California by the Sea, Cincinnati, among other things. Jack, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so these grants were very significant in terms of the amount they are. More than $1.3 million awarded to the University of Cincinnati, $1.8 million plus awarded to Northern Kentucky University. Let's talk about UC's grant first, since you outnumber the NKU representation here. We'll give you all the head start here. Who'd like to lead the discussion on just what this grant aspires to do?
Well, so I can start us off. So we basically have a $1.35 million grant that aims to increase our behavioral health workforce and to be able to enable them to work more effectively with primary care, particularly those who are our data wave prescribers. So those folks who are providing medication-assisted treatment, folks who are working in the field to really make a difference on the opioid epidemic. So we've done well in our society and in our community in terms of increasing the workforce. We have not done so well in terms of our collaborative work and making sure that our folks know their roles individually as well as the roles of each other so they could work more effectively.
Okay, so let's expand on that a little bit. How do we start to designate who's responsible for what?
Sure. So I think the thing we have to think about with this problem is it's multifactorial, it's multigenerational, it's going to have rippling effects. So as we're educating our students and our future healthcare employees, I think it's important to remember that there is this huge interprofessional piece, and we have to address all the complexities that we have with this. So we, as part of our grant, we have embedded a high-fidelity simulation training in a course for the students that will be part of it. So social work, counseling, nursing, our psych mental health nurse practitioner students will be involved, and we are really trying to reduce stigma both within the community at large and the recovery community. We want to coordinate and integrate care so we're decreasing any barriers that people have to access, and we want to identify populations at risk as soon as possible, and we're doing that with simulation, education, and we're building this into our program so that at the end, the workforce that we have will be already equipped to deal with everyone who they'll be dealing with in the care setting, and we can provide the wraparound services that historically we haven't necessarily been able to do.
And Shauna, we've heard throughout this crisis that we've been facing over the last better part of a decade at this point, there's money that comes in from here or there for this organization or that organization, maybe a health department, maybe some type of recovery center. But this is money that is going to help facilitate some work through the universities. So help us understand the role that universities will play in this situation.
Right. Well, we know that students really need to understand where addiction comes from, how we can address this issue. And so students go to school to learn specific information, but it's great to be able to also provide them specific funds to be able to go to school and take specific classes, have internship experiences. And so these students will receive some specific stipends to help them offset the costs for their education. And so we have these specific experiences that they will engage in. And also, we have great collaborators where they're going to have their internships. So we have the Cat House, we have Talbert House, we have UC. I mean, those are just some of the places that they're able to experience and work with these individuals. And so we have professionals who are trained who will be working with these students to show how to engage and work with people who have addictions.
And Valerie, NKU was awarded $1.8 million. Is your plan similar to what's going on at UC, or is there a difference?
I think it's different. It's different along two dimensions. One is our grant is almost exclusively focused on the rural areas of Northern Kentucky. And just to give a bit of a background for what the situation is there, we've all heard the good news that opiate deaths are decreasing across the country. And in Kentucky, they're down 30%. That's fantastic. They're actually up in Owen County. And the second thing is, even though the deaths are declining in Kentucky, the number of hospitalizations, ER drives, first responders responding to an overdose, those are all actually up. And so my point here is that the opiate problem is still a huge problem there. It's just now we're much better at keeping people from dying of it. Owen County in particular is challenged because they have no hospital there. They have no urgent care. There's no one that is waivered to provide a medication-assisted treatment. They have about 1.5 counselors who are able to serve the entire county. So they have very few resources available to help combat this epidemic. So our charge in one of the grants is to try to help them figure out how to provide the appropriate wraparound care that my colleagues here were talking about when you almost have no resources to dedicate toward it. So we'd be able to hire some personnel that would work exclusively in Owen County, but also help educate the people in the county about what resources are available. And if they're not in the county, then how to access them outside of the county. Because they don't have, just given their location, they don't have a one-stop shop where they might go. Because Cincinnati's far away, Louisville's far away, Lexington's far away, Frankfort is far away. What do? That's one grant. Then we have a second grant that is dedicated to helping us figure out how better to educate our peer support specialists. So in Ohio, for example, they have training that is certified by the state that's online. In Kentucky right now, everything is face-to-face. Again, this is a real problem for people who live in rural areas because they quite often are unable to take off from work for 40 hours to travel to the nearest urban area to receive the training. And so we're hoping with the second grant, again, we're able to reach out and touch the rural areas, which are really struggling with this epidemic in a way that I think other places are starting to have a sigh of relief about.
How have those rural counties that are included in, I often say there's capital N Northern Kentucky, and then there's lowercase N Northern Kentucky.
Right.
Capital N, sort of the more populous three counties at the top, and then the lowercase, the more geographic composition that includes Owen County. Mm-hmm. And for those listening who may not know exactly where that is, it's basically if you're going down 71 towards Louisville, you do pass through Owen County, I believe, right after you get through Gallatin County. So
where the
racetrack is, and then you pass into where Owen County is. So in those counties, who's been on the front lines of this issue and obviously struggling to answer this call?
I have to say, at least in Owen County, they're really there's not been a consistent front line, and that's one of the challenges. Because what we see in Owen County, and I believe it's replicated in other rural areas, is the people don't know where to go when they have a health issue, and they are under-resourced, medically speaking. So they go to the ER, and that's their primary care provider. But then what happens is all the providers within the county don't see the clientele, so they don't get resourced, so then they leave. And so then people really don't know where to go, so they go to the ER, and you get this downward spiral of resources just being cut and cut. And now people in Owen County and other areas are very frustrated because they see the problem, but what they see is providers come in and they leave. They come in and they leave. And so now they don't trust people who are coming into the county saying, we're going to help you all, because they believe, in a few months, you'll be gone just like everyone else. So I'm not sure there is a group that you can really point to as being on the front lines consistently over the past few years.
Let's talk a little bit about the struggles that some of these folks face once they're overcome by addiction. Jack Stem is on the phone with us. He has overcome, or has at least been dealing with, his own addiction and is now working on the other side of things. Jack, thanks again for joining us. Why don't you give us a little bit of your backstory?
I was an emergency room nurse at Christ Hospital here in Cincinnati, and then went into nurse anesthesia, trained late 70s, practiced through the mid-90s, developed addiction as a result of a chronic back problem, which fortunately was fixed by some surgery. But when you work in anesthesia and have access to drugs like fentanyl and sufentanil and those kinds of medications and you're addicted, that's not a good thing. And unfortunately, I struggled a lot with treatment and early recovery. Eventually, was able to achieve long-standing recovery. I'm on 24 and a half years, and in the process became peer assistance advisor for Ohio State's nurse anesthetist. Now I'm on the national committee with the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists, and I became a chemical dependency counselor. I work at Hotel California by the Sea, and actually have a child that's in recovery as well. So we see it from both sides.
So, Jack,
it's been a long haul.
Yeah, it sounds like it. How is it being in recovery? I want to be careful with the words I use, because I know that there are special ways to phrase this so as to be sensitive to people who've dealt with it. But do you struggle at all, even after all this time?
I mean, the changes that occur in the brain are permanent, as we apparently find through research up to this point. Now, I don't know if we're going to develop therapies that are going to help with that. I still have triggers. I still have cravings. Fortunately, they are not as bad as they were 24 and a half years ago. But, you know, you walk into a situation and there's something there that triggers the desire. And if you don't have a plan in place, you're in trouble. Because, boy, it can snowball. So, I keep working my program. I think one of the problems we have is this is a chronic disease. Mm-hmm. It is not a short-term disease, and we've been treating it like a short-term disease.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you next, Jack, was I understand you're going to be consulting on the UC side of this federal grant, and I'm just curious from your perspective as someone who has been through this or is going through it still, do you see anything from your perspective that has been missing from the region's response to the crisis?
Lack of education at all levels. I think that's where it starts, because stigma that's associated with the disease comes from lack of understanding. So I think that's the first thing that we need to change. Just go on Facebook and read some of the posts of people who respond to remarks about addiction and recovery, and you'll see that the stigma is alive and well, and stigma keeps people from looking for help, and it keeps people from doing research, and it prevents grants. And, you know, I mean, so we're fortunate that we're changing that, but I think lack of education, lack of understanding kind of drives a lot of this.
Please, Michael, go ahead.
Well, and Jack, we're so fortunate to have you a part of our project here. And I guess one of the things that's really come to light for me is how folks who are receiving medication-assisted treatment, so buprenorphine, Suboxone, other forms of support, often struggle in being received in the recovery community by folks. And I don't, Jack, you might be able to say much more about that than us, but I think that would be really kind of helpful for folks to understand that unique aspect of this crisis that we're dealing with now.
Yeah. Medication-assisted treatment has a negative reputation, not only in the public, I think, but as well as in the recovery community. And again, it results from lack of understanding. Previous treatment center I worked with, my group was actually the Suboxone medication-assisted treatment group, and they would come through my group for education and early counseling before going on to IOP so that we could help them understand how the medication worked and how it affected the brain and the intentions of the program and how we worked with them as well as gave them the medication. And I think continuing counseling is an important part of medication-assisted treatment. This isn't where you just give somebody a medication and they're fixed. We've got got to do the counseling too.
Jack mentioned the stigma that he sees and referenced specifically any comments that you might read on a social media post. And, you know, I work here at WVXU and also publish a newspaper in Northern Kentucky. And I see that anytime that there's stories related to this, I'm wondering if you sense a sense of opioid fatigue in the region and whether that may have any impact on the work that you're doing as you try to get buy-in from community members.
I feel like when I first started doing research in this area, we were hearing a lot more about that. As education has changed and we've really focused on efforts to make sure that providers especially know that this is a chronic disease and the process of addiction is a chronic disease and treating it like a chronic disease, our responses have changed. We recently did a study within a local emergency department group of nurses, and we asked about fatigue, and the answers were astounding. It was so impressive. Nurses were saying things more along the lines of, this is a chronic disease. I treat it like every chronic disease. Every patient that walks in the door, that's how I'm going to treat it. So we're seeing a lot more of that now that we've changed the way that we're looking at it as a society. Versus what I used to hear a lot more with the fatigue.
So specifically about the grant at the University of Cincinnati, what should we see in terms of progress and when should we start seeing work?
Well, so we're in the process now of recruiting students across all three of our programs. So social work, nursing, and also with counseling, mental health counseling. And our students will be in training within their internships over this next year, doing our simulation training over the course of this next year as well. Within 2 years, our folks are going to be out into the field in their different roles, actually making an impact directly outside of their internship experiences. So while they're in the program, they're going to be in the community. They're going to have an impact, but that's going to continue after that point.
Okay. And what's the timeline for the whole exhaustion of the grant funds? How long do we expect this program to go?
We have the grant for 3 years, but we can ask for an extension if necessary for another year. So hopefully we'll also get some further funding to help continue to do this. But we do track the students and see how they do, where they end up job-wise, and what kind of impact they have on the community. And we do report that to our funders. And for our own purposes, we really take a look at that. So we're constantly looking at how we can improve our programs, what differences it makes in the community, and get feedback from our agencies where the clients are, and also where the students end up being at, what can we do differently? So we really take an approach of getting feedback from everyone.
And Valerie, since the NKU funds are going to be focused on the more rural counties in Northern Kentucky, I'm wondering if you've witnessed what I feel like I've witnessed there, is that the rural counties of Northern Kentucky have responded more quickly as best they could to this crisis than the more urban ones. And I would reference specifically the syringe access programs that were so delayed to arrive in Kenton and Campbell counties and still aren't available in Boone County, whereas Grant and Pendleton counties both had operational needle exchange or syringe access programs long before they did. Are you seeing a sense of urgency in Owen County as well?
Yes, I do see a sense of urgency. And I think also now the stigma has changed among the general population. When we did some surveys getting ready for submission for this grant, we discovered that citizens would say, well, I believe it's a chronic disease, but my neighbors think that it's just a matter of will. So really what we need to encourage there now is just an open conversation about what's going on. But at the same time, in the providers, we're seeing compassion fatigue, because they're seeing the same people over and over. And even if you repeat to yourself, it's a chronic disease, it's a chronic disease, it gets really, really hard when you see what, from your perception, is people making irrational choices or choices that ultimately is harmful to themselves and not really knowing what to do about it.
Our thanks to Dr. Valerie Hardcastle, Dr. Angela Clark, Professor Shauna Aquavita, and Dr. Michael Brubaker, and Jack Stem for joining us. Appreciate the conversation today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstrow. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.